You're listening to the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney and I'm with Daniel Freed.
Hello, Lionel.
Good evening.
How's it going?
Not too bad. It's been very warm today, hasn't it, here in Spain?
Not your weather at all, is it?
No, I'm turning pink. Very pink.
Turning. The gerund. I don't think we need the gerund there. I think we need the past participle.
Yeah, well, I would have fitted in on the beach at Peníscola because there were a lot of very pink people there. Some had gone beyond pink to mahogany. I don't know what fate awaits me, but this is not the sort of weather I like working in, certainly.
No, there was about 35, 36 degrees, certainly when we set out this morning from Alcañiz. And it's a very hot part of Spain, isn't it? Long way inland. There was a bit of a breeze, though. And
it was a hot breeze, though, wasn't it? It was like being in a hairdryer.
It was, and we went through some... That reminds me, actually, the hairdryer. Did I tell you about overhearing the Caio Rural team talk the other day?
I think you did, no. Yeah. I think you've said this,
sure.
On the podcast.
This on the podcast?
No, if not. Tell it again,
possibly
if you've already
not
heard
possibly
this.
Not. Well, they missed a break 2 days in a row in their home region, and... I found myself in a position, not deliberately, but I did find myself at the bottom of the Caio Rural steps, the bus steps, on Saturday morning. And I forget the name of their main director sportif, he's a Basque. And I heard him really giving them the Alex Ferguson treatment, the hairdryer, telling them in no uncertain terms that they had 2 days, really, the weekend to sort of restore some dignity and save their Vuelta.
Was he not annoyed that they were all looking at their phones at some point as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, there was something to that effect, yeah.
Well, it's the modern world now, isn't it? Everybody's looking at their phone, probably trying to download the cycling podcast, I'll be bound. Anyway, let's talk about stage 16 of the Vuelta, 156 kilometres, probably the quietest stage of the race on a very hot day. Six riders made the early break: Davide Villela of Cannondale, Mario Costa of Lamprey, Sylvain Dillier of BMC, Sven-Erik Bystrom of Katusha, Luis Angel Mate of Cofidis, and Julien Maurice of Direct Energy. And their lead was never more than 3.5 minutes, really. It never looked like it was going to work out. With 17 kilometres to go, Dillier attacked and was followed by Mate and Bystrom. The others were caught, and then with 12 kilometres to go, it was all back together. With 3 kilometres left, Daniele Bernatti of Tinkoff took a flyer. Really impressive late move. He's obviously a good sprinter, and we have seen him try these kind of almost Filippo Pozzato winning Milan-San Remo.
I'm glad that you didn't use any other reference point than you used Pozzato, for whom these moves have never, ever resulted in success.
Apart from Milan-San Remo 2006.
Well, not really. He was away over the Poggio, wasn't he?
True enough. Okay. But okay. All right. Anyway, Bernatti took a flyer and he held off the bunch until inside 500 metres to go. A really strong effort from him. But in the sprint, it was the Luxembourg rider Jean-Pierre Drucker of BMC who was by far the strongest. And this was the 10th stage of this race that was won by a first-time Grand Tour stage winner. It really has been the race of the breakthrough performance. Second and third were two German riders, Rudi Sellig of Bora and Nikias Arndt of Giant Alpecin. Tomorrow is a rest day, and we'll be back on Wednesday when the race resumes. But this morning, Daniel, I was in Alcañiz, and I was having a chat, not on tape, with quite an agitated Sean Yates of the Tinkoff team. He's one of the sports directors there, and he was still smarting a little bit from the decision to allow the 91 riders who finished outside the time limit at Formigal to continue in the race. And I'll paraphrase what he said, but basically he thought that the riders weren't taking it seriously enough and that they had a duty to maintain a full and strong effort to get to the line as quickly as possible and not sit up. I was doing a bit of a calculation on the average speed. The stage was won by Gianluca Brambilla with an average speed of around 40 kilometres an hour, just over, for the 118 kilometres. And the Gruppetto averaged 31 kilometres an hour. That's, again, pretty dawdly pace. It's not like they tried to ride on and make their best effort to get over the line inside the time cut. And Yates was annoyed because he said, well, there'll be riders in that group who may well go on and shape the race. They might make it difficult on another day, and perhaps they shouldn't still be in the race. And of course, Well, we saw at the finish, Daniele Benatti, who did make the time cut yesterday, was away. And Drucker and all the other riders in the top 10 were, should have been, could have been eliminated if they had applied the letter of the law. Now, we'll just hear from three people who offer differing opinions, because this is one that divides people. So this morning I also spoke to Max Chiandri, sports director of BMC Racing. So let's hear what his verdict was.
When did sports director become de rigueur in the cycling podcast? We're supposed to be the last bastion of proper cycling vernacular.
We should be calling them director sportif, but we're in Spain.
Well, no, but come on. Director sportif.
Oh, no, no. Because
it's in the style guide.
It's not in the style guide because this is quite a deviation here, but Tinkoff and BMC both refer to their staff as sports directors.
We don't call Sky Soigneurs carers.
No, we don't.
We do it to them. Director sportif, cycling podcast style guide says that director sportif is the de rigueur.
This is in danger of becoming almost as controversial as the whether or not the rider should have been allowed to continue in the race. We're gonna be inundated now. If you're Team Daniel and you think we should always refer to them as director sportif, then say so on Twitter. And if you think sports director
and on the sportif.
Oh, goodness. Anyway, can we get back to the program? Can we get back to the program? So, Max Chiandri, the sports director of BMC Racing. Let's hear what his verdict was on yesterday's stage.
It comes down to, you know, okay, rule is a rule and needs to be applied. Then it went down. You know, I think the riders could have put a little bit more effort into trying to stay closer to the time limit. I think they just really said, okay, let's stay together and we can finish in an hour and a half. They'll put us back in. They almost knew it. If it should have been applied or not, we had four riders in and four riders out because Gilbert was already gone. He's gone home, so we're 50-50. I think some teams had probably... they would have had one rider at the start today, so I just leave it, you know, with a no comment, really. I mean, yes, you should have gone home. I mean, I think they should have gone home, really, to tell you the truth.
It would have made a real statement, wouldn't it? That look, the race is there, the rule is there, you've got to make an effort to get to the line.
Again, it goes down to these rules they have, you know. That's a rule what I accept, you know. There is a time that you need to finish. And a rule I don't accept is like, you know, a guy yesterday wanted a drink at 8K to go and the commissaire says no. You know, so some things I agree and some things I completely go against. We could talk about a lot of things I think are right and wrong, but they're all my point.
Do you think there's enough consultation between the people who make the rules and everyone, you know, no, the people who run the teams, zero. The riders?
Zero. They just make the rules and that's it. They should come inside the teams and see how they run and understand things a little bit more and then make rules around it. Not to please people, but just to be more realistic with stuff.
I mean, it would have been an amazing story for cycling. Talk about generating headlines. If they kicked out over half the race yesterday, I mean, you can't buy that kind of publicity, but it all got kind of massaged away and as if it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. We did a... I wasn't there that year, but Tirreno Adriatico, and you could probably go and do a little research on the records. It started with probably 18 riders, two stages to go. The whole peloton got kicked out. So
I'd love to have seen today with 60 guys left, Chris Froome all on his own.
At the end of the day, the helicopter is going to show the front guys. They're going to show the break, 5 guys, 6 guys, 1 guy, 10 guys. So it'll still be 60 guys racing. Some team cars would have had one bike on the roof or three of the same. That would have been pretty strange to see.
So, Daniel, perhaps more as a desire to see a bit of mischief, Max Chiandri would have liked to have seen all those riders eliminated from the race. But the riders themselves obviously have a different point of view. And I spoke to Koen de Kort of Giant Alpecin after the finish today, 24 hours after the duster settled, to see what his point of view was.
Okay, I saw you tweet last night to say you'd never missed a time cut in a Grand Tour before, but yesterday you were in the Gruppetto that was a long, long way behind the time cut. Can you describe what it was like in there? Was there much conversation going on? You obviously knew you had safety in numbers, very unlikely that they'd kick out so many riders, but what was it like in there?
First of all, I'd like to say that I'd never missed time cut altogether, not juniors, under 23, professionals in a single race. So it was very unusual. And yeah, as you said, we didn't just miss it. We missed it by quite a large margin. I guess it's a bit of the how Def Vuelta has been so far. It's been really, really hard. Yeah, then after a 7-hour mountain stage that was really, really tough, the next day we've got a little 3-kilometer, 4-kilometer climb right from kilometer zero. And just there, the best climbers in the world decide to attack each other. The bunch basically split with two groups of great riders chasing each other. And yeah, the group behind, we knew that we had no chance. We were not coming back because they were all racing full gas in the front. And those were the best riders, so we weren't going to come back. At first, Sky was chasing. I thought that they were going to wait for us and then all ride together, but yeah, that was not their tactic. And at one point they set up, and yeah, it's basic math. We were not going to make it. We knew straight away. Like, we saw that the time cut. We knew that was only going to be about half an hour. And yeah, we would lose in that group 15 minutes on the last climb, and yeah, by the time we would start riding and, you know, keep pace, then we knew we were not going to make it. What we decided to do is all stick together, not safety in numbers, trying to, you know, knew that they weren't going to take us out. It was more, you know, just finally looking after each other and making sure we would all stay together. We can all race full gas, and you have a group that misses the time cut by 5 minutes, and a group by 10 minutes, and a group by 20 minutes. And yeah, I think then we ride our own teammates and our own colleagues home for the sole purpose of riding them home, not for making time cuts. We weren't going to make it anyway.
I suppose that's one of the points that hasn't really been made, is that if the front of the gruppetto had pushed on and then maybe put 10 guys out the back, then those 10 guys would definitely have been eliminated maybe, and so you were all looking for the collective of getting everybody home.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, if we would have done that, who knows, a few guys would have made time cut, but it means that two or three of my colleagues, my friends, would have to go home because I pushed them to. And, you know, I think we're always racing and we're always competing and we're trying to win races, but just racing for the sole purpose of eliminating your teammates, I think that was a good decision of the group to stick together.
And lastly on that, was there much conversation on the climb? Were you aware that it was quite an unusual circumstance and that the clock had ticked on so much?
Yes, absolutely. It was basically straight away. We knew it. There was a bit of a talk, a few guys that were trying to push the pace, and which meant that some teammates from other riders were getting dropped. And yeah, right then there was basically an understanding between the group that we would basically ride the pace of the slowest rider and stick together in this one.
Cohn de Court there making the point that it was almost like a unionised decision to make sure that all the riders got home, rather than pushing on at the front and perhaps eliminating a handful or 10 or 12. The final word on this, well, other than Daniel, of course, who will come in a minute, but the final word on this from Javier Guillen, the race director of the Vuelta. Do you think that you would have generated a lot of publicity if the jury yesterday had, for example, eliminated all the riders that were out of the time limit? It would have been a huge story for cycling, and everybody would be talking about how over half of the peloton didn't manage to make it in time.
Well, it's a good question, and for sure, as organizer, I never want to have this situation in the race. But now, when you have to take the decision, you know, what's much better? A peloton with 70 riders and no more teams in the peloton for the next year, and we have 1 week before us. Or the best solution is to thin in general cycling and to say, okay, well, you are 91, 93 guys out, but if I don't rescue you, you know, your teams get not the publicity, you know, Vuelta is not a good platform for now one because you are not here, you know. This is something difficult to manage, because in one hand, when people says those guys should be eliminated, okay, and today all those people says, oh, I don't interest what you are offering me because all those guys are not here. So it's not easy. To me, the best solution, never mind what happened to work yesterday. Because we lose everybody. Everybody, not only organizer, not only public, not only the city. Everybody, especially teams and riders. So I hope, and you know, it never happened again.
So Daniel, the race director, making it clear that he had no desire to see riders eliminated. I think you're certainly on that side of the fence as well, that it would have been extraordinary to have applied the rule rather than turn a blind eye, which is what happens 99.9% of the time.
Yeah, it would have been. I mean, I'm going to actually read out the relevant UCI regulation, Lionel. It's regulation number 2.6.032, finishing deadline. The finishing deadline shall be set in the specific conditions or in the specific regulations for each race in accordance with the characteristics of the stage. In exceptional cases only, unpredictable and of force majeure, the commissaires panel may extend the finishing time limit after consultation with the organiser. In case riders out of the time limit are given a second chance by the president of the commissaires panel, they shall have confiscated the... This is terrible English, isn't it? They shall have confiscated the equivalent points awarded to the winner of the same stage to their individual... Well, we don't really care about this anyway, do we? The points and whatever penalty they might incur. But the words used there are exceptional cases only, unpredictable and of force majeure. So I took this morning to the chief commissaire on the Vuelta, a French fellow called Hervé Broch, or Broch. And I asked him, how can yesterday's circumstances be described as exceptional? And he said, well, it's exceptional in the sense that the result would have been exceptional. 71 riders would have been left in the Vuelta, and that is how they justified it. That is how they rationalised it. However, he also said that at the end of this Vuelta, he will submit a report in which he advocates a change to the rule, a change to the regulation. So we'll watch that with great interest, won't we? But I also spoke to a lot of riders this morning. Bram Tankink's been a professional about 18 years, something like that. He said there have only really been two occasions when he feels it's been abused, and yesterday was one, or when the gruppetto has finished miles outside the time limit. So he says it's not commonplace for the gruppetto to really abuse it. Joe Dombrowski, he was the odd one out for Cannondale yesterday. He was the only Cannondale rider who was outside the time limit. I staged a debate this morning between Moreno Moser and Joe Dombrowski because Moser was inside the time limit and quite outspoken on Twitter, said that the rider should have been eliminated. And Dombrowski's very sensible suggestion was that the commissaires who are on the race, who are on motorbikes or in cars, and you know, are in the race for the duration of the stage, if they felt that the gruppetto was really abusing the rule, there should have been probably some dialogue, and they should have told the gruppetto that they needed to hurry up. However, Dombrowski did admit they really didn't try very hard at all yesterday.
Well, clearly not, because the average speed bears that out. It was interesting talking to Javier Guillen, and I made the point that it would have been an extraordinary story. The spotlight would have been on the Vuelta in perhaps not the most welcome way, but it would have been something that would have generated headlines and controversy and interest. But, you know, is that justification to make an example of 71 riders? Probably not. On balance, I think, you know, they're in the race now. It was inevitable that somebody was going to do something in these remaining days to alter and influence the race. It just so happens that today the stage winner and all of the other riders who are up there in the sprint were outside the time limit yesterday. But I think draw a line under it, really, and kind of move on.
Yeah, but you know, let's suppose that the rule does get changed. I mean, what is the solution to this problem? Without having thought it through in any great detail, I would suggest that the solution is probably slightly generous, more generous time limits, particularly on these short stages, particularly if this is the way that cycling is going to go, with shorter and shorter stages, and a rigorous enforcement and an invariable enforcement of the rule.
Yeah, so there's no grey areas, no discussion. If you're outside the time limit, you're outside. And I suppose that lends a certain amount of drama, doesn't it, particularly to the mountain stages. But I did kind of think, you know, think of all the times, all the hours, the days that the likes of Mark Cavendish and Andre Greipel and Marcel Kittel and so on have really turned themselves inside out to make a time limit on the Tour de France, you know, fearing that they might be made an example of. But anyway, let's move that one on. Daniel, I think you've got a little update on one of the other
slightly controversial talking points from yesterday, and that was Astana lending quite a hefty shoulder to Sky or Chris Froome's battle to try and limit his losses.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of challenged Alexander Schaefer, the sports director of Astana, this morning in
such a weird thing to pick a point.
We don't call it a peloton, like, you know.
I mean, occasionally call it the bunch.
It's full of French vocabulary, isn't it?
We're in Spain.
They come on place. Anyway, I challenged Schaefer about it this morning about the amount of work that Astana had done in that second group with Froome yesterday. And he, as you would probably expect, he put up quite a staunch defence of his team's tactics. He said that they'd missed the break and they hadn't come to the Vuelta on holiday to be, you know, to sunbathe on the beach. They'd come to compete, and if the team misses a break, they have to work. However, when he gave me this answer, he was visibly trembling, which sort of undermined the credibility of it slightly.
Were his eyes darting from left to right as he was speaking? Did it not have the ring of authenticity, his answer there?
Possibly. I mean, Schaefer is not someone that I've interviewed a lot, and he seems to me to be quite nervous when he was answering my question, so I'm not sure.
A slightly serious point, though, there, Daniel, is that it's not uncommon, if a team misses a break or fouls up in some way, it's not uncommon for a sports director or director sportif, depending on which language we want to talk in, to get on the radio and dish out a bit of punishment and say, look, guys, you've missed a break, you are now going to chase all day. I mean, it's been a sort of staple of some of the French teams at times, hasn't it, when they've made mistakes?
Yeah, and I think the culture at Astana is quite unique in that regard. I had a long conversation a few days ago with the press officer there, Jeffrey Pizzorni, who's an Italian, and he said that it really is a different culture there, in the sense that there is no excuse at Astana. There is no sense of we performed well, the guys did a great ride and they finished second or they finished third and that should be applauded. It is victory or nothing. And that's certainly very different to a lot of teams, I think, in the World Tour. I think credit is given for things besides a victory. But Astana, it's perhaps not the case. And perhaps yesterday, you know, they were almost being punished for having missed that break.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you to Eurosport for their continued sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast, enabling us to be out here at the Vuelta. Daniel, I drove the course today. I think you did too. I had a slightly eventful day, as ever. But it was a stunning route, wasn't it? I wasn't expecting the landscape that unfolded before me. It was really quite attractive, you know, very, you know, brown hues, but it was hot, summery.
Big landscapes, weren't they, Lionel?
Big landscapes, yeah. And the climb in the middle of the stage up to the sort of very old town, absolutely glorious looking. You know, I imagine looked very well on TV as well.
It was almost an old school Vuelta stage, wasn't it? It was the kind of stage that we used to get a lot of in the 90s. Kind of big roads, very beautiful landscapes, but very arid, deserted landscapes. And yeah, not an awful lot happening on the stage, it has to be said. I don't know where this could be long, Lionel, if I go into a tangent about the Osborne Bull. Do you know what the Osborne Bull is?
Is this the logo iconic, we see all over?
It's not been seen.
I saw a Citroen 2CV painted yellow and red. The flanks were red, the middle was yellow, or was it the other way around? Anyway, like the Spanish flag, and it had the bull on the bonnet and on both doors, and it was by the side of the road.
The Osborne Bull, I mean, I certainly remember from, you know, watching Vueltas in the 90s, you would see it on an almost daily basis, and that really reflected the regions where there are a lot of Osborne Bulls. I'm not going to tell the whole story of the Osborne Bull. I recommend that people look it up on Wikipedia, because it's quite fascinating. In short, the bull, this iconic sort of advertising hoarding in the shape of a bull, which you see in various places in Spain, it was conceived as an advertisement for brandy company. And
you've got my attention.
Yeah, and this year we have not seen a single one. I know this because I have an encyclopedic knowledge of where the Osborne bulls are in Spain, and we've not seen a single one on the whole route.
These are the great big cutout black balls, aren't they, that are sort of like advertising hoardings, but there's no wording on them at all, is there? They're just a solid black, very muscular looking bull. But you're right, yeah. But I did see them today in, well, as I say, on a Citroen 2CV.
Badly wrong.
I did, yeah. I went badly wrong today. Anyway, less of that. We're in Castellón this evening, aren't we? Which is, it's not quite what I was hoping for. I've not been lucky so far. I feel like Richard got the better of the towns and the landscapes, and I got the bit that I already know from the Tour de France, and then the long, long drives. But you know, I'm not bitter about it, but I'm enjoying my trip to the Vuelta. What have we got in store over the rest of the week, Daniel?
Well, we've got a tough summit finish on Wednesday. So I say summit finish. It's a typical Vuelta summit finish. I just forget exactly the name of where we're finishing, but it's a 3.5 kilometer extremely steep ramp. I don't know if some listeners might remember or might be familiar with the Zoret de Cati climb near Alicante. This is a very similar climb. So we've got that on Wednesday, and then we've got a fairly uneventful stage coming on Thursday. Then we've got the time trial, which, of course, everyone has been talking about and debating and wondering whether Chris Froome can take back enough time on Nairo Quintana on Friday.
Well, just on that, before we move on to Saturday, the story brewing is of the fires down in that region near Javier. As I drove down the motorway this evening, the billboards above, the electronic kind of signs above the motorway, were warning of extreme fire hazards. It's very, very warm, isn't it? And you do get the sense that, you know, just a stray cigarette butt might create a real... well, everyone smokes over here. I mean, I've checked into my hotel room and
spoken like a wannabe arsonist.
No, I'm not. Oh, dear. No.
Not to tempt fate, but if one were to...
if one were to desire an enormous blaze. No, I mean, we shouldn't make light of this, because it's a serious problem in the quite close proximity to the... to the time trial course on Friday, and at this stage we don't yet know whether that's going to have any impact or not. Still a few days to go, so presumably there's plenty of time to get that situation under control. Don't know what's happened in the last few hours even on that one, but certainly something that is on the radar of the Vuelta organisers this evening. And then Saturday is the final uphill finish, the final chance for any jiggery pokery on GC, isn't it?
Yeah, you look at the general classification, so you got Froome 3:37 behind Quintana. You've got Chavez 3:57 and Contador 4:02. Yates 5:07. I mean, who can make serious ground that day on the time trial day? I think Talansky could end. He could find himself in the top five in the Vuelta, because he is currently 6:43 down on Nairo Quintana, and Simon Yates is 5:07 down. I think Simon Yates could well be in Talansky's sight, if, of course, Talansky doesn't shed any more time on that mountaintop finish. And we've got the Aitana on Saturday, which itself is a very difficult finish.
Talansky has been riding in the tradition of Jaime Zubeldia, hasn't he? A very, almost the invisible GC rider of that group, really.
I've seen Zubeldia. He's been spotted several times in this Vuelta, both before, during and after stages.
Well, I should have brought my Ala Zubeldia t-shirt with me, but I didn't pack that one. If you want an Ala Zubeldia t-shirt, I think they're still available on the cyclingpodcast.com. Go to the shop section. They may not be available, actually. I know there's a new range of t-shirts, isn't there? There's a special Vuelta Pedaleur de Charme, which is yellow and red wording on a black t-shirt. Looks very smart. Anything else, Daniel, before we go and have some tapas? You asked me what my impressions of Spain were. It's not been quite what I expected, but I had anticipated some really good eating, and unfortunately it's not worked out that way due to circumstances. Not your fault, obviously.
Not Spain's fault either.
No, we were in France for, you know, a day and a half, really, weren't we? So we got what we expected there. But we should probably stroll into the old town here, if there is one, and find somewhere pleasant to eat.
Indeed.
Rest day tomorrow, so we'll be back on Wednesday. In the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Lionel.